71 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is the New Comics Wednesday episode for August 22nd, 2018. I'm going to talk in detail about a few of the books that are coming out this Wednesday as you listen to this. And then I'll talk more, I'll give a rundown about some of the other books that you might want to be on the lookout for. There's a lot of good titles coming out this Wednesday. So obviously I try to keep it spoiler free, but I did get a chance to read a few of the books that are coming out today, thanks to the publishers that send me preview copies. Always grateful for that. So I'm going to kick it off this week with Shadowman number 6. The creative team, it's written by Andy Diggle. The art is by Renato Guedes. The letters are by Simon Boland. So first let me talk about the art. I have said on this podcast before that I'm not a big fan of Renato Guedes. If he paints everything like he does in this issue, then man, I'm totally on board. Because this issue is fully painted and it's gorgeous and there's so much detail and there's so much nuance and there's so much depth and it's just beautiful to look at. And here's the other thing about Renato. Apparently, he's always a lot faster when he paints as opposed to when he does pencils. So I just got to put it out there, like, why would you ever do pencils, Renato? Just stick with the painting, man, because this stuff is beautiful. So just to get everybody caught up, if you haven't been reading Shadow Man, when Andy Diggle took over the book, I don't want to necessarily say that he wanted to redeem Jack Boniface, the guy who presently is imbued with the Shadow Loa. But the character certainly needed to be redeemed as far as from a publishing standpoint. The new Valiant has just never seemed to find its footing with the new Shadow Man, with a new take on the character. I kind of felt like what the path they were going down at first wasn't bad. I actually enjoyed it, but a lot of longtime fans didn't. And then they tried to fix it and Peter Milligan came in and it just seemed to mess it up more. Matt Kent even took a turn and the stuff he did was interesting, but it just didn't feel that much like Shadow Man. So Andy Diggle has come on and we've seen Jack, you know, rescued from the dead side and then get thrown back in. And now from a quote unquote booby trap set by Baron Samedi, he's tumbling through time. And he got to experience the era of the 1940s with his great-grandfather and then the very first of his bloodline, Marius Boniface, Civil War veteran. He kind of lived through him for a little while. And now he's tumbling back even further, back into the mysterious void from even before Jack's bloodline, possibly. So that's where we are in this issue. So, and Diggle goes kind of meta in this issue, and we even see Jack, or hear Jack rather, speculating himself on whether Samedi was trying to teach him a lesson, something that I had speculated that, hey, maybe, not that Samedi was trying to teach him a lesson, but maybe by Jack traveling back through time and inhabiting and seeing through the eyes, kind of being a passenger in the life of these other shadow men who have been able to control the Loa, perhaps Jack will learn something. Perhaps this is the training that he's always needed, sort of on-the-job training, but the training he's always needed and he's never received. He even mentioned in the book, this issue, that a lot of these other ancestors of his were trained from the beginning to be a vessel because they knew they were going to be a host for the Loa at one point. Jack never had that benefit, right? So it's interesting to think if that's what's going to happen. But even beyond that, I mean, Jack falls all the way back to 40,000 BC and is encountering kind of, we're seeing the origin of Shadow Man really for the first time. And I think that's amazing. I think it's adding depth. And there's also some things going on. It's hinted at a little bit in this issue, things that are happening in the current day, which which kind of show me that Diggle is not discounting anything that happened before in previous iterations for this go round of Valiant. So I like that as well. He's not, you know, throwing out everything, saying everything that was done before is crap and we're going to start over. And it's also fun to speculate if Samedi is the one that sent Jack on this mission, was it for him to learn? Because Samedi wants to use him in some way. Is Samedi perhaps not all bad? That's interesting to think about, right? If you start thinking about Samedi in the terms that we think about Toyo Harada, right? Who's such a great character in the Valiant universe because he does live in that gray area so much. You know, is he a hero? Is he a villain? So far, Samedi's been very much the mustache twirler in the Valiant universe. But if Diggle could change that and make him a more complex and ambiguous character as far as his morality goes, that is going to make him more compelling. It is going to make him more interesting. So kudos to everybody involved with the Shadow Man title. I feel like this issue, well, I feel like issue 4, where we first saw Jack fall through time, kind of upped the game of the series, kind of took it to the next level. And now with this issue, it's been raised again. Diggle and Guedes and the rest of the creative team have definitely raised the bar again. And I got to say, 6 issues in, this is the best Shadow Man title from this go-round of Valiant anyway that we've seen to date. So kudos to everybody involved. I was really impressed, really enjoyed the issue. I think it was, it was awesome. It was awesome. All right, let me move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It is Shanghai Red, number 3. And I'm going to read the creative team as they are credited. We have Joshua Hickson on art, colors, and cover. We have Christopher Sabella with script and design. We have Hassan Atsmain Alahu on letters. We've got a variant cover by Tess Fowler and Marissa Louise. And the logo was done by Dylan Todd. So a lot of people helping to put this together. I did feel like the art in this particular issue wasn't quite as tight as the art was in the first couple issues. And that's not to say that the art in the first couple issues was really tight either. It tended to be a little looser, but I felt like in this issue, it was even more loose. And I'm not sure if that's purposeful on Hickson's part. I will say that this particular issue it's mostly female characters that are sharing the spotlight in this issue. So that might be part of the reason why he wanted to go with a little bit of a softer style, which is perfectly fine. I'm not saying the art is bad by any stretch of the imagination. He's very expressive. He doesn't really venture into any uncharted or all his panel layouts are pretty standard, right? Like it's rectangles and squares on the page. He's not going into any, you know, breaking any new ground, so to speak. But being the time period and the type of story this is, it kind of works for it, right? I mean, it's set in the 1800s. It's in Portland. It's somewhat of a period piece, right? And so I kind of feel like keeping it pretty straight and not going dynamic with the panel layouts on the page kind of helps set that tone of kind of a story being told from the past. So I have no problem with the art, no problem with the panel layouts. I think his sense of storytelling is good, especially love the way some of the panels seem to have a mist in them. You know, again, it suits the fact that it's Portland. You know, it's by the sea and all that kind of stuff. So really enjoy the art. It's definitely a mature title. It's not for the faint of heart. Lots of blood, lots of violence. And the story that's been going on so far has been pretty good. It's been pretty good. If you haven't been following along, it's the story of a woman. You know, this is that will spoil the first issue for you a little bit. who got shanghaied because she was basically living as a man in Portland because she was always a tomboy. And she couldn't really find the kind of work that she wanted to do as a woman. And she could easily pass for a man, so she did. And she ends up getting shanghaied. And if you don't know what that means, it's like you get drugged or you're passed out drunk. Back in the 1800s in a port town, you were very likely to wake up on a ship because the ne'er-do-wells of the town that would frequent the bars, they'd go and recruit. They'd go and scoop you up, either drug your drink on purpose to then basically sell you into slavery or, you know, find you as just a gift laying on the street or passed out at the bar and take you to one of the ships in the harbor and sell you to the ship. And you'd be an indentured servant, basically, because you'd wake up the next morning and the ship would be out to sea and you were stuck there. And if you wanted to eat and you wanted to be returned to port, you had to work. And if you didn't, then you'd starve or they'd throw you overboard or they'd, you know, beat you to death. So it certainly wasn't a good existence by any stretch. And now that this girl Red is back home, she's looking for revenge. And in this issue, we get kind of some more of the background of exactly what's going on in Portland. And Hickson and Sabella are kind of setting the stage for the next part of the story. So I feel like much like Shadow Man raised the bar, Shanghai Red 3 kind of shifts the focus of the story. And Red comes to learn that because it wasn't like they conspired to just take her. She just got caught up in the machine, right? The corrupt machine of the city, both crime and politics and the way things were kind of the Wild West back then, you know, almost literally. And there wasn't protection. There was, you know, corruption among police and city officials, and they were paid to look the other way. Very much a thing that went on. So it's been a really interesting story so far. It's been, I feel that if it's not historically accurate, at least it's plausible, right? Again, the art by Hickson sets the mood very well. And same thing with the colors that he does. So I've really been enjoying it. I'm not sure how much the dialogue is period accurate, but it's certainly good dialogue. It's not stilted. I much rather would have Sabella script it this way and not try to go historically accurate and have it end up being kind of like wonky and stilted and seemingly fake and not very genuine. So much rather, I mean, they do kind of seem to speak more with a little bit of a modern flavor, but again, I'm perfectly happy with that. And the other thing is, other than just kind of that surface story of someone being shanghaied and wanting revenge, we're also getting, you know, some historical themes in as much as these women are trying to live lives where they basically make their own choices and they have their own freedoms and they're, you know, allowed to kind of have independence, because that certainly wasn't a thing at this period in time when, you know, they weren't allowed to own property and couldn't vote and all kinds of stuff like that. So I don't know that Hickson and Sabella are specifically trying to comment on that, but it's certainly a byproduct of the time period they're setting their story in. And it is certainly something that's touched upon in this issue. So I think Shanghai Red is really good. I was very surprised by just how good it was. I didn't read like a whole lot or maybe even anything about it before it came out. I just trusted, well, it's Christopher Sabella. I like his writing. I'll go ahead and pick up the first issue. And based on the name Shanghai Red, based on the picture I'd seen of the first cover, I honestly thought it was going to be a book about pirates. It's clearly not that. It's so much more than that. And, you know, revenge stories are not the most original, but the time period that the creators are putting this in, the themes they're seem to be exploring that they're not hitting you over the head with. It's kind of adjacent or oblique to the story that they're trying to tell, and the quality of the storytelling. It's very impactful and visceral. I think it's a really good book. So if you haven't checked it out, I do recommend it for sure. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Damage, Annual 1. This book continues to be written by Robert Venditti. The artwork, or at least the pencil work, on Damage Annual 1 is from Aaron Lopresti. We've got inks by Matt Ryan and colors by Hi-Fi. So this is basically the origin of Damage, so to speak. I mean, we kind of know, if you've been reading the Damage book, we kind of know already that, you know, they took a guy from the military who volunteered and they shot him with the serum, and now he turns into like this engine of destruction for an hour at a time. So there's definitely some similarities with the Hulk. And then there are some differences as well. These two, they definitely seem to be two different entities. It's not Ethan Avery morphing into Damage. I mean, like physically he turns into Damage, but Damage seems to be a different person, right? Like they can talk to each other. It's completely a different persona. Is it another being, even another living being? It's not Ethan Avery. That I don't know. And maybe Venditti himself hasn't figured it out, but they are two different people and they are two different entities, and they can even communicate at times. So it wasn't like we didn't know how he was created, but this issue isn't about necessarily the creation of Damage, but it's more about his origin. Like, how did Ethan Avery come to be aware of who he was as Damage? And how did he come to realize that he didn't want to stay with the Damage program? Why did he volunteer in the first place? Why did the Damage program, like, why did he, we found out actually in the last issue, I think it was issue 8 of Damage, like why he woke up, saw the unknown soldier come and make an appearance. We found out why Ethan Avery woke up over Atlanta. And in this issue, this annual, we see some incredible fight scenes from Lopresti with some other Damage-like creatures. We meet Ethan Avery from before he was Damaged. We learn about his sacrifice and his bravery on the battlefield. We learn why he volunteered for the Damaged program. And we see for the first time when Avery and Damage, as two separate entities, speak to each other for the first time. And this all leads into Damage number 9, which goes on sale September 19th. So I think that this was a perfect time for the annual and a perfect time for this story, because we got so many hints in issue 8 with the unknown soldier appearing and him kind of explaining the part that he had in Avery escaping from Colonel Jonas and the rest of the Damage project. So here we're getting context. If I had to sum up this story with one word, that's what it would be. It would be context. We're understanding the motivations of Ethan Avery. We're understanding why he felt compelled to run away from the program. And we're also learning a lot about Colonel Jonas herself and her motivations and why she does what she does. So this is not a narrative that's like 100% original, but it is one that's completely plausible. And by that I mean, you know, somebody volunteers for something and the government ends up taking it a lot further than they probably morally and ethically should, because in their mind, the way they justify it is it's for the greater good. And they're just keeping the person doing the terrible things in the dark, right? Like, as long as we have plausible deniability, as long as we can say, we didn't do that. And they're wiping Avery's memory clean of all the missions, then they think they're in the clear, right? But that's not how things play out once Avery and Damage kind of become aware of one another. So if you're enjoying the Damage series, this is an absolute must read. You have to pick this up and read it. You're not going to understand as much about the characters or the story going forward if you don't. If you're not reading Damage, I do recommend it. Probably pick up the first volume. Pretty cheap. I kind of wonder how well this title's selling. I haven't heard much about it. And really, all the where they were called New Metal series, I guess, at first, and then New Age of Heroes, and it just, the Initiative sounded like really great when it was first announced, and then it got delayed and lost momentum, and then the artists that were supposed to be such an integral part of the books were moved on to other things very quickly. Like Jim Lee ended up doing like half an issue of the first issue of Immortal Men. And I think everyone else has moved on to other stuff, with the possible exception of Kenneth Roquefort. He may still be doing the Sideways series. But Tony Daniel was on Damage, and his art was incredible, and it was awesome. And then he moved on to something else, Batman, I suppose. And, you know, I'm not blaming Tony by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, Batman's a much higher profile gig, right? But, you know, DC sold these as like being these art first books and artists move the needle kind of thing and all kinds of stuff. And the guys, the artists unfortunately moved on like really quickly, and it's just unfortunate. So I think that as a book and a character that's similar to the Hulk, it's certainly not a blatant ripoff. The characters are actually quite different. There are similarities, but the way that the characters both Damage as compared to Hulk and Ethan Avery as compared to Bruce Banner, they're completely different characters. It doesn't feel like a total homage or like, oh, Venditti's ripping off Hulk stories he read. No, it's not that at all. And I'm really enjoying Damage. It's probably my favorite, if not in the top two, of the New Age of Heroes titles. And I'm also glad that we got a lot of Colonel Jonas and kind of understanding her motivations in this issue. I think it helps to bring context to the decisions that she makes or she has made in the ongoing Damage series. So another book I recommend for sure. All right. Up next, I'm going to talk about Justice League Dark number 2. This is written by James Tynan IV. We've got pencils by Alvaro Martinez Bueno. We've got inks by Raul Fernandez and colors by Brad Anderson with letters by Rob Lee. There's also a really cool variant cover from Greg Capullo, Jonathan Glapion, and FCO Placencia. So this picks up right where the first issue left off of Justice League Dark and ends with us being introduced to this super creepy, scary being who is going to be central to the story going forward, in the words of James Tynan. His name is the Upside Down Man, and he is just creepy, creepy, creepy looking. We also see Dr. Fate make an appearance in this issue, as well as John Constantine. So there's no shortage of guest stars. And we also, Tynan's hitting the ground running. Like with Justice League Dark number one, we learned that because the source wall was broken, magic users, like magic wasn't working right, the magic was kind of attacking them. And in this issue, we kind of learn why the magic users in the DC universe aren't able to control the magic anymore. And it makes sense. And it's really an interesting idea. And all this time, Tynan is just keeping the momentum going. The story keeps ramping up as more and more things are revealed. We're getting more and more details and finding out that things are much worse than we first found out in the first issue. And that ended bad enough, right? With Zatanna's father showing up and saying, yeah, magic's broken. Not only are the magic users in trouble, but the entire universe is in trouble. And one of the supposed heroes is going to be the final straw, right? It's going to be someone's going to betray everybody else, and that's what's going to lead to the downfall of Earth and magic users and destruction of reality, basically. So you think, oh, that's pretty bad. It can't really get much worse. Oh, yeah, it can. When the Upside Down Man shows up, it can get a whole lot worse. So credit Tynan for really hitting the ground running with this title. I know a lot of these characters are very popular and beloved. Constantine, Zatanna, Dr. Fate. There's a big fan base out there that loves these magical, some of them more obscure than others, characters. You know, Zatanna and Constantine are pretty well known, and they're totally beloved. Wonder Woman as well. But, you know, you throw like Detective Chimp in and Man-Bat, and we'll see some Dead Man, and we'll see some Jason Blood and Morgan Le Fay, Zariel, all those guys. Swamp Thing, yeah, you're gonna get that fan base that loves the magic corner of the DC universe, which I feel is a corner that's been neglected for kind of a while. I mean, we did have the Justice League Dark title in the New 52, but that had a much different feel. That had more, even though it was Justice League Dark and they were dealing with supernatural things, it still had a superhero vibe to it. This title definitely feels rooted in something darker, which kind of makes sense considering that Tynan's talked about the fact that he wants to make this not just the scariest Justice League book in the DC universe, but the scariest book ever in the DC universe. And he's succeeding so far with telling the story at this breakneck pace and constantly building on the drama, constantly like piling on more and more details about just how bad things are. Like if I was Wonder Woman, I'd feel like I was at the bottom of a very, very deep hole, trying to dig my way out. And every time I grabbed the wall to try to pull myself up, more dirt would fall off and bury me, in way over her head, her and, Swamp Thing and Zatanna, all of them. So the details that were revealed in this issue, as I said, they really ramp up the story, really raise the level of danger, and the creepiness factor in this issue with seeing the Upside Down Man for the first time. I mean, he is just straight up creepy looking. Like, it's an image that I don't want to look at it, right? Like, I don't want to see him. I don't want to see him anymore. I don't want to see him show up again next issue because he's not pleasant to look at. And it's not like he's overtly like gory or disgusting or whatever, but he's just so unpleasant. He's so unsettling, right? Like kind of reminds me of Hellraiser, like one of the I think they're called Cenobites, because they're just like totally creepy looking, right? So kudos to both Tynan for an incredibly well-crafted, well-structured issue, very tightly plotted, and he's, like I said, he's really ramping up the tension, which kind of need in a book that you want to be scary, right? Like, you're building the drama, you're building the suspense. And also Alvaro Martinez Bueno? I already forgot. Sorry about that. Alvaro Martinez Bueno, because I think there is an Alvaro Martinez. Anyway, kudos to him as well. His artwork is spectacular, very detailed, very, I don't want to say visceral, but it's very emotional. And he does a great job on the backgrounds. And I mean, when he draws the Upside Down Man, it's just so darn creepy. He also likes to mess around with panel layouts a lot. Like, there's a lot of insets, which I really enjoy. And the panels aren't all, you know, rectangles with straight lines and everything. And there's even a couple of, almost like a montage piece here or there. So I really, really enjoy this art. I think it's done really, really well. And obviously Raul Fernandez on inks. Again, he's doing a great job. He's letting Bueno's best work show through. Because I feel like he's keeping it really tight and really clean. Because it's already somewhat of a dark book based on the subject matter. And so there can be a tendency to over ink it, right? To go really heavy and dark and a lot of thick lines. But then you lose movement. You lose a sense of like forward momentum with the characters. And it just feels like everything's kind of thick and heavy and blocked down and slow. And being that it's so fast paced, you want to make sure that you keep it tight and more light as far as line weights. And I think Martinez does Ralph Fernandez does an incredible job at that. And also the colors. You know, it's not a superhero book per se. So yes, it has heroes in it, but it's the magic corner of the universe. So, and I've talked about how dark and suspenseful the story is. So you definitely want more of a muted palette. But again, there's the danger to go too dark based on the subject matter. And there are plenty of pages colored by Brad Anderson where there's a lot of black and the colors are more muted. But we also see Dr. Fate, and you know, he's always been somewhat of a brighter character in terms of using his magic, a lot of yellow, a lot of glowing magic and things like that. And Brad Anderson doesn't disappoint us on those levels either. So like art team wise, couldn't ask for anything more. It's done really, really well. And yeah, I just can't get that. I just turned to that last page again with Upside Down Man. I had to turn off of it because it's just not an image I want in my head, especially before I go to sleep at night. So, all right, well, let me move on to the last book that I'm going to talk about in some detail. And it's my book of the week. And it's by one of my favorite writers, Brian Edward Hill. We've got pencils by Miguel Mondaca, inks by Diana Egea, colors by Adriano Lucas, and letters by Sal Cipriani. It's the finale of Brian Michael Bendis' run on Detective Comics with Batman. And I hope you all have been reading this. We've had some amazing variant covers from Mark Brooks. But even beyond that, we've had Brian Edward Hill's take on Batman and Black Lightning. That's right. He brought Black Lightning into the Batman universe, or into a Batman book, and he's been writing Jefferson Pierce and a lot of the supporting cast, a lot of the Batman family. We've seen Duke Thomas or The Signal. We've seen a lot of Orphan, or that version of Batgirl, who I know Brian Edward Hill is a fan of. We've seen Barbara Gordon. We haven't seen Barbara Gordon as Batgirl, but we have seen Barbara Gordon, and we've seen Katana. We see Katana show up in this last issue. So it's been incredible. I love the story that Brian has been telling, and he's kind of been dropping hints all along that this could be something more. And I don't want to spoil it because I want you all to read it for yourself. But at the end of this book, we kind of get some confirmation that, you know, dare to dream. Could this be possible? So it's not 100%. And I haven't heard any announcements. I don't know if maybe DC doesn't want to spoil it either. But I'll just say that I'm hoping we get more Brian Edward Hill writing Batman, because I think he does a great service to the history of the character. He explores Batman, like who Batman is centrally, more so than any writer I've seen in a long time, which that's saying something, right? Considering we've had Scott Snyder and Tom King both kind of exploring different elements of what makes Batman, Batman. But I feel like their takes, Snyder's for sure, King may be a little closer to what Brian Edward Hill's doing. He's doing it overtly, right? He's doing it metatextually, where Bruce himself, in the context of the story, is being forced to look at himself, to look at who he is. Whereas I think, Scott never really did that, at least not to the level that, not at the intellectual level that Brian Edward Hill is doing it. Scott did explore it a little bit on the emotional level, especially with Bruce deciding not to be Batman anymore, the whole Endgame story with Joker. But he was more reacting. Here, I feel like he's intellectualizing it more. And over in Tom King's story, I feel like what's going on right now is Bruce is losing himself in Batman to kind of hide the pain of the loss of Catwoman. And I mean, it's Tom King, so of course it's going to be moody and morose and all that. But I don't feel like Bruce is as self-aware in either of those recent runs as Brian Edward Hill writes him, which I love because of course he would be self-aware. Of course he would be self-analyzing. Of course he would not be able to turn that part of his brain off. He would always be analyzing, just like he analyzes any situation he gets himself into, just like he analyzes every person he comes in contact with, because Batman, as we know, is a planner. It's what he does. It's kind of his superpower to figure things out, to be the smartest guy in the room. And Brian has really challenged that here with, I mean, last issue we saw Batman basically get his butt kicked. So he came up with a unique and interesting villain, which although that's resolved in this issue, it also opened up a brand new path for a lot more issues or problems or antagonists for Batman and Jefferson Pierce and maybe the rest of the team to go up against. Although it's a satisfying arc and it is a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, it may not be the end of Brian Edward Hill working on Batman, because this arc also really plants some seeds to tell more stories. And again, I know I'm being kind of vague and I'm trying to like hint at it or what have you, but it's just because, again, I don't want to spoil it for you. So I thought this issue was spectacular. I thought the whole run was spectacular. I love the voice that Brian Edward Hill gives to Batman. His voice for Jefferson Pierce, I have to be honest, I'm not sure how much I like it or how much I don't. I haven't read a lot of Black Lightning. What Black Lightning I did read was probably in the late 80s, 90s in the Outsiders book. And that Jefferson Pierce is a lot different from this one, I feel like. I mean, in general, it's the same. He's still a teacher. He still has the same kind of powers. Although it seems like Black Lightning, this version, has a better mastery of his powers. But that's 20, 30 years ago. Right. So it would only stand to reason that an African-American character back then doesn't necessarily speak like an African-American character does now. And, you know, he's just a little different. And again, I just haven't read anything of him that recently. So it's not that I think that Brian's voice for Jefferson Pierce is inaccurate or wrong or I didn't like it. I'm not the right one to say, is that how Black Lightning should sound? Because again, I'm just not that familiar with him. I didn't have any problem with him. I loved him much more in costume than out. Liked what he was doing with his powers. I liked kind of his leadership skills on the battlefield, so to speak. But when he was Jefferson Pierce, I just didn't know that I necessarily was understanding who he was as a person. I think I need to read more. But Brian did do a great job with Orphan and the Signal and Katana, even though she was there very briefly. Barbara Gordon to some extent as well. I thought he got all of them pretty pitch perfect. Alfred as well, who is certainly one of the most important supporting characters in any Batman book. So I have to say, as much as I was looking forward to having Brian Edward Hill tell a Batman story, introduce a new villain, have Black Lightning in the book, and know it was going to be good because it was Brian Edward Hill. Like, all those expectations, he still surprised me. It still was even better than I expected. I mean, this is just a great, great Batman story. And part of what makes it so great is all those little seeds, all those little hints that are dropped that this could become something so much more, part of, you know, the beginning of part of a larger story, part of a new era for Batman. I mean, that would just be awesome in my mind. So, also, Miguel Mendonca did three of the five issues. I think Felipe Bernones did the other two as far as pencils go. And the art was great all throughout. I especially liked the Miguel Mendonca issues. Just like his style a little more. It's a little more traditionally comic booky, a little tighter. Great storytelling, great transitions from panel to panel, some really nice page layouts as far as the panels on the page, you know, non-traditional shaped panels, and yeah, it was spectacular. And the last thing I'll mention is how great Brian's dialogue was as well, because it's one thing to get the voice and the tone down correctly of the characters, but you also have to get their, like, their the way they speak and their vocabulary and everything needs to be right so that they come across as the characters they're supposed to be, as these icons that we've grown up reading and we've read for years and that we, you know, care about so much. So I thought it was spectacular. It completely exceeded my expectations. I wish Brian was staying on Detective Comics. Maybe he'll come back to it at some point. I really hope that he does, because this was absolutely spectacular. And again, I'm on a run of like 3 or 4 weeks in a row where, like, looking at the titles, I find myself wondering, well, on paper, it looks like it might be a tough choice of what's going to be Book of the Week. But then once I read the books, there's one of them that just stands out to me where I'm like, well, I'm picking this for sure. There's no way I can't. And that's the case again this week. I had to pick Detective Comics 987. Because again, I just think that Brian Edward Hill really understands who Batman is at his core. And you could almost say that who Batman is how he saves the day. It's how he finally defeats the bad guy, so to speak. And it's food for thought. Like, it's something that I'm, even though this arc is over and Brian's run on Batman is over, he left, you know, despite the story seeds that he planted for something to come out of, which would be awesome and I would totally be on board with, there's also some seeds of, wow, Batman's kind of messed up, which, you know, that we've seen that before, but in, this is a new way of looking at it. And again, it leaves something there to still think about. Like, man, what is Bruce carrying around inside him? You know, like, maybe we don't understand him quite as well as we think we do. And is he a hero? Even little doubts like that, which, you know, I know for some people, like, my Batman's a hero and he's got to be this way, that way, whatever. No, I like that there's things to think about when it comes to Bruce Wayne, Batman. I think despite him not having superpowers, and on paper he could not necessarily work that well and get kind of boring because two-dimensional, right? Like, you know, cliche, person has something terrible happen to them and decides to, you know, get their, spend the rest of their life getting revenge on it. You know, that's a pretty standard story, right? Bruce had something bad, his parents died, he decides to take his revenge out on criminals for the rest of his life. It's pretty simple when you think about it. But Brian Edward Hill and others have really built on that and made it so much richer and with more layers and everything. And Brian definitely taps into that here with not necessarily thinking of Bruce as a damaged character, so to speak, but just thinking about, man, what is it that he carries around inside of him, you know, that he feels he probably has to carry around inside of him to keep going, to keep doing what it is that he does day in and day out, standing between us and insanity or darkness or evil or however you want to put it. So yeah, really, really great job. Congrats, Brian, on an excellent Batman run. All right, let me go ahead and run down the list of some other titles you may want to be on the lookout for today when you head into your comic shop. From Aftershock Comics, no floppies or single issues this week, but we do have the second volume of Jimmy's Bastards from Garth Ennis and Russ Braun. Over at Boom, we have Big Trouble in Little China, Old Man Jack, number 12. From DC, in addition to the books I talked about, we have Action Comics 1002, and Adam from Talking Superman is going to join me. We're going to talk about that on this week's Superman Sunday, so if you're curious about that book, definitely tune in for that. Let's see. There's also Flash 53 from Joshua Williamson, and Silencer number 8 from Dan Abnett, as well as Terrifics number 7 from Jeff Lemire, and Steve Orlando's continuing his Wonder Woman story with issue 53. Over at Image, we have Aphrodite 5, number 2, Stairway, original graphic novel, and Witchblade number 7. Those are all Top Cow books, and I'm going to be talking about all of them on Top Cow Thursday this week, so tune in tomorrow if you want more details on those. That will be a spoiler-filled podcast. I'm not going to go like page by page, but I will be talking about some things that will be spoilers for those books. So forewarned is forearmed. Also from Image, we have Cold Spots number 1. It's a new horror title from Cullen Bunn. Curse Words Summer Swimsuit Special number 1 from Charles Soule and Ryan Brown. Die, 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 number 2 from Robert Kirkman and Chris Burnham. I still haven't read the first issue of that, although I heard it was really, really good. I did pick it up, and I'm planning on picking up Die, 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 number 2. Also from Jeff Lemire, we've got Royal City, number 14. Over at Marvel, we've got Amazing Spider-Man at number 4 from Nick Spencer and Ryan Otley. We've got Avengers, number 6. Black Panther is up to number 3. We've got Hunt for Wolverine, Mystery and Madripoor, number 4, which we'll be talking about on our next Hunt for Wolverine Spotlight episode. Life of Captain Marvel is up to issue 2. We've got a brand new Punisher, number 1, and I think that's the one that's being written by Matthew Rosenberg, if I'm not mistaken. And we also have a West Coast Avengers, number 1. I think that one's being written by Kelly Thompson. And the last thing I'll mention is, in addition to Shadow Man number 6 from Valiant, we've got Britannia, Lost Eagles of Rome, issue number 2, and Quantum and Woody number 9. Oh, and I also should mention Wasted Space number 4 from Michael Morisi from Vault Comics. That one sold out like all its issues at the distributor, so those Wasted Space books can be pretty tough to find, so you definitely want to pre-order the trade paperback. Let your retailer know you want it, because that's a really hot book, and like I said, the singles are getting pretty tough to find. They're doing, I think, a third printing for the first issue, and they're on a second printing for issue 2. And it also got announced that that's gone from being a limited, I think it was originally planned as a 5 or 6 issue, to an ongoing. So it's a really great story. Michael Morisi's been on the show a couple times and talked about it. So if you're curious, you can just do a quick search for Michael Morisi and learn what Wasted Space is all about. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Quick reminder, everybody, I will be at Comic-Con Palm Springs on Saturday. What's the date on that? It is the 25th. I'm just going for the one day. But if you are going to be there on Saturday and want to meet up, tell me what you like about the show, grab a picture, whatever. I'd love to meet you. I'll also hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard. So presents and pictures. So once again, I want to thank everyone for joining me, and we'll talk to you next time.